Good evening and welcome to Chicago Tonight. I'm Paris Schutz. Brandis Friedman has the evening off. Here's what we're looking at tonight.
We believe that justice has been served.
Why Cook County is no longer prosecuting R. Kelly.
In the blue corner, attempting to become the city's first black mayor, Harold Washington.
Why does Chicago have nonpartisan elections? Our latest edition of WTTW News Explains has the answer. And with that in mind, why some candidates for mayor are calling Paul Vallas a, quote, secret Republican.
We deserve equal rights.
A renewed effort in the century-long battle for a constitutional amendment to protect women's rights.
Who are you?
Bass Reeves.
Walked into the production staff that was still on board and said, I'm directing.
And longtime actor Isaiah Washington talks about his directorial debut in a new film. Now some of today's top stories. After 3+ years, the state's public health emergency declaration around COVID will come to an end. Governor J.B. Pritzker announced the disaster proclamation would end on May 11th, aligning with President Biden's decision to end the declaration at the national level. The declaration allowed the state to tap federal emergency funds and also gave the governor sweeping powers to enact shutdowns and curfews. Pritzker says the move isn't a proclamation that COVID has disappeared. He says the virus is still a clear and present danger, especially to those with compromised immune systems. The popular discount mall in Little Village will stay open for now. The owner of the mall says it has extended the lease for vendors through March after it was set to expire today. Development company Novak Construction bought the mall 3 years ago, and its fate has been uncertain ever since. The worry among local officials is that Novak will tear it down in favor of a possible big box retailer. Community members attended a meeting tonight demanding Novak keep the discount mall in business. The trial in the case of the 4th of July Highland Park massacre has been delayed. A judge granted prosecutors more time to gather evidence against Robert Cremo III, who is accused of firing an assault rifle during that parade, killing 7 and wounding dozens more. Cremo is indicted on 117 felony counts. The next hearing in this case is scheduled for May. The new and improved International Terminal 5 at O'Hare is open for business. The terminal has added 10 new gates and a bunch of amenities, which should theoretically mean smoother travel and more food and shopping options. It's part of the overall $12 billion plan to renovate the entire airport. This part of the project costs around $1.2 billion. The plan eventually calls for the replacement of Domestic Terminal 2 as a new, quote, global terminal with domestic and international flights.
This $1.3 billion expansion and renovation project has brought the once state-of-the-art building back to its original glory.
And the entire modernization project is expected to be completed by 2030. And up next in the program, state's attorney Kim Fox is here to explain why she's no longer pursuing charges against R. Kelly. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabey family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Cook County is ending its nearly 4-year case against disgraced R&B singer R. Kelly, and it ends with the charges basically dropped. The decision comes as Kelly has already been sentenced to prison for decades, with more to be added in another sentencing next month. Kelly's been convicted of a slew of crimes in other jurisdictions, including child pornography and sex trafficking. And joining us to talk about the decision to drop the case here is Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. State's Attorney Fox, so welcome back to Chicago Tonight.
Thank you.
So a lot of the same charges that you had prosecuted him on, why drop this case?
Well, certainly when we started this case back in February of 2019, the federal charges had not yet been levied. We had a hotline. We had people call in. We had victims, witnesses. Our office worked on the investigations. We received the child pornography tape, tendered that to the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Chicago, and then the subsequent cases came. And as a result, Mr. Kelly right now is serving, he's 7 months into a 30-year sentence on one set of charges. We'll be sentenced in a few weeks on the child pornography case here in Chicago.
That's a federal case.
The federal case. So essentially, Mr. Kelly is looking at, even before we got to the state cases, spending the rest of his life in prison. And so as a result of that, we believe that justice has been served, and our resources are best suited for dealing with cases that are pending in Cook County now.
And that was going to be my next question, because you said you want to redirect the resources where they're needed. So what are those areas that are needed?
You know, our sex crimes division, our sexual assault domestic violence division, has hundreds of cases right now that are pending. And certainly we can do them all at the same time. But the issue is Mr. Kelly is already serving a 30-year sentence with the possibility of an additional 10 to 90 years on top of that. So he wasn't going to get any additional time from the state charges that we were going to have. And again, many of our witnesses and victims who were going to be in our case have already testified in the federal cases. And so right now, for the cases that are pending, who don't have celebrity defendants, where victims are seeking justice, we're going to continue to work on those cases.
And I do want to quote one of those victims, Lenita Cardo, who was involved in the county's case. Part of her statement said, quote, "Over the past several weeks, I came to learn the state's attorney's office was considering dismissing these cases. I pleaded with Kim Fox and her team to see the cases through. Justice has been denied for me a second time, making today's decision that much more difficult to comprehend and accept." So I understand the notion that Kelly couldn't really have any more punishment than he already has, but what about this particular victim and the feeling that justice is being denied her right now?
You know, listen, I met with Lenita Carter a few months ago. She came forward way back in 2003 and shared what happened to her, went to authorities, did everything that she thought she was supposed to do to get justice, and nothing happened. And so here we were 20 years later. We asked for victims to come forward, and she did. And so I can totally sympathize that she wanted her chance to get into the box and point to him and say what he had done. But the reality is that we have a man who is not going to get any additional time, who is in prison for the remainder of his life right now with the sentence that he has. And that sense of the use of our resources for someone who's been convicted of sex crimes, it is more appropriate for us to stop where we are now, allow her to say what has happened to her, but we don't believe that we should continue these cases in the court of law.
And you mentioned, I mean, especially with Lenita Carter and all these victims, it's so hard to come forward. It takes so much. There's so much fear. Does it possibly send the wrong message to assault survivors?
Not at all. I mean, the reality is when I came out in 2019 and asked for victims, it was an unprecedented move. And I share that I am myself a survivor of sex assault, and I know how difficult that is. In Paris, we got hundreds of calls. Many of those calls, those victims and witnesses have testified, have come forward. Without that, Mr. Kelly wouldn't be seeing the sentences he's seeing today. And so the truth of the matter is the work that those victims did in coming forward has allowed for someone who has been deemed a sexual predator in a court of law to now be serving sentences for his actions. And so, no, it's not discouraging. In fact, I think we should be encouraged by what these victims have done.
And you mentioned all the different state cases, federal cases. Yes. A lot of the cases overlap. You had victims come forward to you that then were part of federal cases. Would it have helped if these cases had been consolidated in some way, at least at the federal level?
You know, I can't speak to how the federal U.S. Attorney's Office decided to go about their charges, but you know, when we filed charges back in February of 2019, we had the child pornography evidence, we had the witnesses who've come forward, and certainly the Eastern District of New York did their own investigation, and we worked collaboratively with them. And so did the Northern District of Illinois. We worked collaboratively with them. And so certainly having three different jurisdictions, now Minnesota, on another state case is onerous. But we respected the process. And again, I believe that justice has been served.
There is justice overall in this process. As you mentioned, he is serving time right now. I want to get to another topic, the cashless bail part of the Safety Act. Yeah. As you know, it's on hold at least until March or April as the case goes to the Illinois Supreme Court. So how is your office adjusting to the fact that your attorneys still have to go and sometimes argue for bail, for cash bond?
You know, we were prepared to go forward on January 1st, and obviously as the litigation played itself out, we'll wait to see what ultimately happens. But our office was ready to go to a cashless bail system on January 1st, and we also have been well ready for years in the system that we currently have. And so not much has changed, but certainly we're looking at the factors that we would be asking for someone to be held and trying to adhere to that so that when the Safety Act ultimately is ruled to be constitutional, which I'm confident it will be, we're prepared as well.
Can you just fill viewers in on what this is going to entail from your attorneys when they might have to take an additional step in front of a judge if someone is accused of a very serious felony to recommend no bond at all? So how are those decisions going to be made? How does that work in bond court?
Well, certainly we look at the existing charge that someone has, whether they are a dangerous person to their community if they're out on bond. And so some of that means talking to witnesses, talking to our folks in pretrial services to determine whether or not someone can be utilizing those services or needs to be held. And so the additional steps are not that much more onerous, other than if we have a victim who we believe we need to talk to immediately regarding their safety if someone is released. But we have staff in place to do that and to make those recommendations to a judge.
And so much has been tweaked about the law, but to be clear, you can use things like failure to show up for court hearings previously as evidence that they shouldn't be released.
Absolutely. So if someone has a history of not coming back to court, again, the purpose of bail was to ensure that people show up for their court dates. So looking at someone's previous history, someone's previous arrest, previous convictions, have they had no contact orders in place before, that entire body of evidence is presented to a judge to make a determination.
All right. State's Attorney Kim Fox, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And up next, a look at why Chicago has nonpartisan elections, so please stick around. When Chicagoans go to the polls to pick a new mayor and alderperson, they won't see the letters R or D. Even though the city has long been a Democratic stronghold and a Republican hasn't been mayor for nearly a century, Chicago has held nonpartisan elections since 1999. Our WTTW News reporter Heather Sharon is here to tell us what prompted that change. Heather, fill us in.
It may be a cliche, but there is truth at the heart of the old saying that Chicago politics ain't beanbag, a warning that the faint of heart should heed. The election of Harold Washington as the city's first black mayor represented a rare loss for the storied Chicago machine, and the powers that be did not take that defeat lying down. If they couldn't beat candidates like Washington, they'd move the goalposts. Our latest edition of WTTW News Explains details what prompted that change more than two decades ago and what it tells us about Chicago politics today.
When Chicagoans go to the polls to vote for mayor, there's a crucial piece of information missing from their ballots, the candidates' political parties. Chicago has held nonpartisan elections for mayor since 1999. If no candidate gets 50% plus one vote, the top two head to a runoff a month later, regardless of their political affiliation. So why the change? We take you to the racially charged 1983 election for mayor. In the blue corner, attempting to become the city's first black mayor, Harold Washington. And in the red corner, Bernie Epton, with his infamous slogan, "Before it's too late." Spoiler alert, Washington won that election, but just barely, with less than 52% of the vote. By comparison, 4 years earlier, Democrat Jane Byrne received a whopping 82% over her Republican opponent. In the primary, Washington went toe-to-toe with Byrne and state's attorney Richard M. Daley, who split the white vote, granting Washington a narrow victory and his spot as the Democratic nominee. The current runoff system would have pit Washington against Byrne. Instead, he faced the relatively unknown and Republican, but white, Epton, and just barely clinched a win. Still, Washington did win. So white Chicago political leaders took a page from southern states, using runoffs to keep black candidates from winning. And in 1995, with the support of then-Mayor Richard M. Daley and a Republican-controlled state government, the current nonpartisan system was put in place. If Republicans thought the change would boost their chances, they have been bitterly disappointed. The last member of the GOP to be elected mayor of Chicago was Big Bill Thompson in 1927. But in politics, hope springs eternal, even if you have to change the rules to try and win the game.
Wow, we all remember the big Bill Thompson era in Chicago politics. So, Heather, the idea here is the runoff would help protect the machine candidate as long as that candidate finished first or second in the initial round of voting.
Exactly. So this was really the political calculus that the victory of Harold Washington changed. Not only was he the first black mayor of Chicago, he also brought out hundreds of thousands of black Chicagoans to register to vote and cast their ballot. That made it impossible for the Daley machine to operate the way it once did.
And even with the issue, the election being nonpartisan, the issue of party affiliation still comes up from time to time, doesn't it?
And it's been front and center in this race, with Lori Lightfoot, a Democrat, trying to convince voters that Paul Vallis, also a Democrat, is actually a Republican in heart, if not in name.
All right, so she's trying to paint Vallis as a Republican. At the same time, she says she would like to face Vallis if the contest goes to a runoff. Why is she saying that? Let's listen to what she told reporters last week.
I would love to have Paul Vallis as my runoff challenger. That's an ideal matchup for us.
All right, I have my own ideas on this, but Heather, why does she want to face Vallis of all those candidates?
Well, simply put, she thinks she can beat Vallis in a head-to-head contest. In that contest, she would be the more progressive candidate in the race, and she thinks that would give her an advantage over Vallis, who has taken conservative positions and accepted the endorsement of the Chicago Police Union, whose leader is a Trump supporter.
And we should be clear that Vallis is a Democrat. He's run in many elections in Illinois as a Democrat, was Pat Quinn's running mate several years ago, for instance. So what are some of these positions outside of Democratic orthodoxy that he's taken?
Well, Vallis got his start in Chicago politics as head of the Chicago Public Schools, and he really turned that into an entire career as a school turnaround expert. And that he sort of pushed charters, privatization efforts, and he favors the use of vouchers, which would give parents public money to send their kids to private schools.
All right, so there's one candidate in this race that publicly declares he's neither Republican nor Democrat. Who is that?
Willie Wilson. Even though he ran for president in 2016 as a Democrat and then voted for Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, in 2016, he says he's neither a Democrat nor a Republican. Of course, when he ran for U.S. Senate a few years ago, he was a member of the Willie Wilson Party.
I think that's a party that has a membership of Uno to this point. Heather, just Willie Wilson. All right, thanks very much.
Thanks, Paris.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. While you're there, make sure to check out the other animated videos in our WTTW News Explains series. You can find it all at WTTW.com/news. Up next, a renewed push in the fight for a constitutional amendment. But first, we take a look at the weather. The U.S. Constitution was last amended in 1992, the provision that deals with congressional pay. But there's another idea advocates have been trying to get added to the Constitution for 100 years. That's the Equal Rights Amendment. Amanda Vinicky joins us now with more. Amanda.
Yeah, Paris, the concept behind the Equal Rights Amendment has been around for literally a century, but it is getting a renewed push now, thanks in large part to this summer's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the legal right to an abortion. The sponsor of the U.S. House resolution that could add the ERA to the Constitution says she's tired of women being subjected to second-class legal status.
It is long past time the Constitution affirm our equality in the eyes of the law. The ramifications run deep as women face daily sexism, pregnancy discrimination, pay inequities, sexual violence, and legislated attacks on our bodily autonomy and more.
And we see Senator Durbin there pushing this in the Senate. So, Amanda, remind us exactly what the ERA would do.
Well, the language itself is short and it is simple. It reads, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Now, as for what that means on a practical level, it would enshrine the rights of women and LGBTQ individuals in the Constitution. Advocates say beyond the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote, there are no express protections for women in the Constitution. Laws that give women protections can be overturned, but that is harder to do with a constitutional right versus a law. Head of the feminist majority points to the Dobbs decision overturning Roe.
They clearly said that the Equal Protection Clause did not cover sex discrimination. Are we going to go back and see more things reversed? Access not only to contraception, not being able to marry who you want to marry. I mean, what is this?
Amanda, you mentioned this is a fight that's been lingering for decades. There's been pushes. There have been renewed pushes. What's the status right now?
So 38 states have ratified the ERA. That is enough for it to effectively have passed. Problem is, some states did so only recently, including Illinois, the second to the last state to ratify in 2018, which is long past a deadline Congress had set for states to achieve ratification. Critics say the ERA, therefore, dead. It is too late. But advocates are not giving up. Illinois senior U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says early in his political career, he worked for the Illinois Senate, where a first assignment dealt with the ERA.
That was almost 50 years ago. They say to be a legislator, you have to be patient, but this is ridiculous. It's time for us to get the job done.
Durbin will play a role in all of this moving forward. Backers have resolutions in the House and in the Senate that would effectively force the issue, remove that deadline, allow the ERA to be part of the U.S. Constitution. Durbin heads the Senate Judiciary Committee and says he will soon hold a hearing to get going on just that.
All right, if you had to prognosticate, Amanda, what are the chances this time?
Well, advocates are very persistent, and as I said, they're particularly motivated. They say that they're ready to use mechanisms like the filibuster and discharge. But really, this is going to be tough. A while back, this was not a partisan issue, but it has very much become one. And again, abortion is a large part of that. Anti-abortion advocates say the ERA would remove protections for the unborn. Critics also say it would overturn labor and other protections for women and for pregnant people, include women in the military draft, and that it would erase legal and biological distinctions.
All right.
There you go.
Amanda, thanks for following this for us.
Thank you, Ferris.
And we're back with more Chicago Tonight right after this. Actor and director Isaiah Washington's new film, Corsicana, explores the life of a black law enforcement officer with very notable stripes. Arts correspondent Angel Ito sat down with Washington while he was in Chicago promoting the film.
It's an opportunity to educate people through cinema. In this case, it's educating the public on historical icon Bass Reeves. He's said to be the first black deputy U.S. Marshal to serve west of the Mississippi River.
I was intrigued by the process because I didn't know who Bass Reeves was.
Shot in Corsicana, Texas, during the pandemic, actor Isaiah Washington found himself taking on his first directing role after most of the production team had quit.
Producers quit. The original actors quit. And I'm like, where's everybody going? And the producers asked me, well, are you leaving? And I said, no. I'm just going to do a Bass Reeves one-man show, something, right? Because it's important.
Sam, you're a lawman?
Federal marshal.
I'm not going home. Walked into the production staff that was still on board and said, I'm directing. Didn't even hesitate. The rest was a blur. Took 120 pages, ripped them all out to 30 pages. And we start shooting those 30 pages until I rewrote everything about Bass Reeves in it.
For nearly three decades, the U.S. Marshal is said to have arrested some of the most dangerous fugitives of his time. Now, Washington credits the cast for their role in properly acknowledging Reeves and his story.
Lou Temple's amazing in it. Blair Underwood, Major Dodge, the guy who wrote the story, Robert Johnson, is actually a real chief of police of Corsicana.
We all kill us, Sam.
Bass Reeves doesn't die in the end. He's a good guy. He's a master at firearms. He's a lawman. He's great at disguises. He's very cunning. He's illiterate. He has a wife. He's wealthy. And he is diverse in how he works with other people. You all see that in the movie in an hour and 42 minutes. Not only important to be in the theater to be inspired, because I see how this movie changes people's DNA when they watch it.
Who are you?
It is far overdue for melanated people to reclaim our contributions and our legacy here in America.
Bass Reeves.
I'm proud of that. That's my narrative.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Angel Ito.
You can see Corsicana, the story of Bass Reeves, at the Cinema Chatham tomorrow and Thursday. And that is our show for this Tuesday night. Don't forget to stay connected with us by signing up for our daily briefing. And you can also get the show, Chicago Tonight, streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news. You can also get the show via podcast and the PBS video app. So many different ways to get the show. And please join us tomorrow night, live at 10. Our Spotlight Politics team examines Mayor Lightfoot's proposed deal with ComEd, which your challengers say is questionable. And Black History Month kicks off. A look at how it got its start and its lasting impact. And now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Paris Schutz. Thanks for watching. Stay warm out there. Have a great evening.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a proud sponsor of diversity, equity, and inclusion-focused free continuing legal education for lawyers throughout the region.